We made this.
Hello, everybody. You're about to hear another crossover between the Movie Palace and the 250 podcast. And just before we get going, I wanted to thank Darren Mooney for editing this recording. I hope you all enjoy this episode.
Hello and welcome to the 250, your weekly podcast. Look at the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. I'm your host, Darren Mooney, and joining me as always, my co-host, Andrew Quinn. How are you, Andrew?
I'm very good, Darren. How are you this morning?
I am very enthusiastic, as you can hear from the sound of my voice.
You ready for some podcasting?
I am indeed. But yes, so this is a special crossover episode. We've got a fantastic guest joining us, the wonderful Carl Sweeney from the Movie Palace podcast. How are you, Carl?
Not bad, thanks, Darren.
Hi, Carl.
Yeah, hi, Andrew. Glad to be with you. It's been a little while, hasn't it? So very much pleased to be back with you.
It has, since Hugo, I think, actually. I think Hugo was the last one we did together. Very much not in the Movie Palace's wheelhouse from a technical, historical standpoint, but really glad that we covered it. This, I think, is perhaps a bit more kind of in the wheelhouse of what the Movie Palace normally does. Ernest Lubitsch, 1942, To Be or Not to Be. Which is a surprise re-entry on the list. It entered, I think, mid last year, having finally hit that kind of threshold of 25,000 votes, which is interesting. So a hot new entry this week.
It's the only Ernest movie on the 250.
It is, unfortunately. Ernest goes to Poland, apparently.
Sorry. I'm sure there's a... There are some Ernest Borgnine movies, aren't there? Do they count?
The Wild Bunch has got to be on there,
yeah.
Has it?
No, I mean, haven't we seen some? Wasn't he...
Escape from New York isn't on there.
Oh,
he was in something.
Yeah.
He was in something, I think. And we remarked how small his Bart was, I think.
Yeah, he was in the insurance movie. Double Indemnity, right?
No.
Am I wrong?
You're wrong.
Okay.
This is why we have Carl on the podcast. But yes, actually, Double Indemnity was one of the first movies that we covered as a crossover, which is great.
It was, I think, yeah.
So I had kind of reached out and I'd said, would you like to talk about or come on and talk with us about To Be or Not to Be? Because the movie I've kind of been watching on the list, I've been very fascinated by. Because again, it's very odd that a movie from the 1940s suddenly arrives on a list of the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah.
And I think you said that you had never seen it before, but were very interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, hadn't seen it. So I just thought it was a nice opportunity, really, because to be honest, I'm not as knowledgeable about Ernst Lubitsch as I would like to be. I have seen a few of his films, but that feels like a real oversight on my part. So I just thought this was a good one to kind of tick off, really, and a big one to tick off in terms of Lubitsch. It's unusual because normally the things I like to podcast about are things I've seen several times and going back several years. So this was a bit of a departure. I couldn't have told you what this film was about before you reached out to me. I was aware of the film. I knew that Ernst Lubitsch made it. I didn't know what the story was, who was in it. And I think that was part of it too. I looked and I thought, well, I've never seen Jack Benny in anything. I'm aware of Jack Benny. Mm. You know, if you'd have asked me who he was, I could have said big radio star, big early television performer. Not sure I could have picked a picture of him out of a lineup, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, nice chance to tick this film off, see something with him in. Carol Lombard's last film as well. Were you aware of it? Or to what extent were you aware of it?
Not really. Like, the only way that I was really aware of it was I thought it was the Mel Brooks film, first of all. The 1982 remake was the first assumption that I made. And I also, then when I dug into it, I knew that it was...
I'm glad I did not watch that one. This time, we had some recent experience.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, we watched Harakiri, and I just text Andrew and said, we're doing Harakiri. And he's like, why? Why is Takeshi Miike's movie on the list?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, Andrew, I have good news and bad news for you. But
I was so bummed watching that movie.
You really were. You text me angrily. Why are we covering this? I think you text me.
It's not that it was a bad movie. It was just that, it put me in a really
very angry,
bad mood.
Nihilistic.
Yeah. Anyway. No, I didn't make that mistake that time. I was kind of hovering over the Mel Brooks one.
the two options. Could you find the Mel Brooks one? I couldn't find the Mel Brooks one to watch anywhere.
It can't. It was the second result, I think.
Ooh.
So they you know, like images come up, We won't say what search engine we use.
Is it supposed to be good? Is it meant to be good Mel Brooks or bad Mel Brooks, that film? Do we know?
Critics' opinion are divided. It was warmly received at the time. Ironically, probably more warmly received than this movie was. Yeah. And we'll get on to talking about that in a second. But the general perception is that Brooks veered too hard into comedy because, again, and we'll talk about this when we talk about this movie, one of the things that this movie does, and arguably one of the reasons why the movie generated some of the response that it did at the time, is that it balances genre. It's a comedy. It's a broad comedy. It stars Jack Benny, as we mentioned. But it is
a farce.
Yeah, but it is also at times very tense. There are stakes. There is tension. And apparently Brooks, you know, did not necessarily manage to balance that particularly well. He veered very much into the farce dimension of it, as you might expect from the director of The Producers. And The Producers was also kind of like influenced by this as well.
Was this before or after Producers that he did this? Because I'm kind of wondering, like,
what would the point be?
You know, if he had already done The Producers, why? And I'm not going to say whether
I think The Producers must have been earlier, mustn't it?
Yeah, it would have been. I think this was just like a victory lap for him. It was just like a, what would you like to do, Mr. Brooks? Because he didn't actually direct it. He just starred in it and produced it.
Oh, I see.
Was there a writer's strike or something?
And he was just like, we already have the script.
We'll just do this one. Yeah.
I was slightly aware of it as Carol Lombard's last film, because again, I've been listening to, you must remember this, the kind of podcast that looks at Hollywood history, and they did a whole season on World War II and movie stars, and it kind of came up in the context of Carol Lombard's very tragic passing as well. But I had never watched it before, and I kind of thought it would be interesting, and as I kind of dug into it, it became even more interesting, because there's a lot of stuff here and I thought it would be fun to talk about. A couple of things Carl's already mentioned that are worth unpacking. Lubitz. Lubitz is a director who was huge at the time. He is generally regarded as one of the fathers of the modern romantic comedy. In fact, I think the movie that he made directly before To Be or Not to Be was The Shop Around the Corner, which like basically codified a lot of what we expect from the modern romantic comedy. It was remade as You've Got Mail. Starring obviously Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks, the original starring Jimmy Stewart, in case you needed more proof that like Tom Hanks was Jimmy Stewart 2.0 or whatever. But he, you know, he was a German director.
How many other Stewart movies have been remade with Tom Hanks? Like spiritual or actual sequels, I wonder.
But
it's another podcast.
That is a separate podcast. That's the Hanks cast. We're hankering for some Hanks. But I do think that, like, again, Lubitz, director, he was, you know, exiled. He moved from Europe to the US. He was brought over, I think, by Mary Pickford. He'd made films in Weimar, Germany. He'd done a lot of work there with the censor, working around the censor in Germany at the time. And it's been suggested that that work in Germany under the censor arguably contributed to why he was so good at the production code, at managing the production code and getting stuff through and under the radar, because like even in this movie was usually controversial, but he managed to get a lot of surprisingly pointed, barbed, sharp content past the censor at a time when you would imagine that, you know, the movie studios would be very, very sensitive about like World War II, given that it was literally happening as this movie was released.
I wonder how much they take into account who is coming from, and I also think it's hilarious, like that he can have that perspective. Like, obviously, it's tragic as well, but to have that perspective, well, I deal with the Nazis, I can deal with you, you know?
Yeah. And also the fact that I think when the film goes into production, I think it's a few weeks before Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And then by the time it's released, it's quite a different context, I think. But yeah, his background's quite interesting because I think his father, who was a tailor, apparently quite a prosperous tailor, so he'd migrated to Germany from Russia in the late 19th century. So his background's very transnational, I think. So born to a Jewish family in obviously a society with a lot of anti-Semitic restrictions. So he had this kind of outsider status both in Germany and then in America. And I think people have said he was pretty attuned to how certain social groups could be excluded. I mean, I think he was a man of his times as well, and there are limitations to that and so on and so forth. But part of that also was that he felt that his appearance and his shortness meant that he was kind of excluded from some norms, because he had been an actor He played a comical Jewish character in these short farces, apparently. But he felt that because of the way he looked, audiences wouldn't accept him as a straight leading man. You know, it's interesting how his influence seems to be on comedy, but those weren't the films that were the reason he was brought to Hollywood, apparently. He'd made these epic costume dramas in Germany. And I think it was a time, wasn't it, where the German film industry was known to be very artistically advanced and a lot of technical expertise was in Germany. And I think the American industry wanted that kind of prestige to kind of rub off on it. So that's part of the reason he was brought over. And then he sort of returns to his roots in the US by making comedies, but of a different kind. They were sort of more sophisticated, whereas before his work had been quite broad and anarchic, is what I've heard. But by the time of this, I think his career had gone through another phase of adjustment, because his style of comedy, the sort of sophisticated pre-code comedies, had fallen out of favor, you know. So I've read that this film is more political and more personal than his other work, really, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's worth singling out as well. You mentioned, like, the idea of him as an actor. I think that, like, Hitler apparently very famously had, like, an axe to grind with Lubitz. In fact, yeah, like, Lubitz actually appears in the Nazi propaganda film The Eternal Jew, you know, as an archetype of corruption depravity, which is apparently footage taken from the director in Berlin on his last visit, 6 weeks before Hitler was sworn in as chancellor. So, it, like, again, it's kind of interesting that tension exists there as well. And I think, like, Lubitz at the time was probably best known for the Lubitz touch, which is, yeah, like, to get this, gives you a sense of, like, and you mentioned, like, how eager the Hollywood studios were to have him. I think he signed a contract with Fox back in March 1941. Like, he signed a free form, no restrictions, final cut, make your own project deal with Fox, I think, in March 1941, which was relatively unheard of, particularly for a director like this. But he was known for the Lubitz touch, and the Lubitz touch was pretty much exactly what we talked about there. It was his ability to sneak stuff past the censor or past the radar. And in the context of romantic comedies, it was things like lots of references to sex and sexuality and, like, body references and allusions to the act of sex, which were things that, obviously, with the production code coming in 1934, I think, were basically, no, you can't have those in movies anymore.
The thing I like about the code as well, and about getting things past the code, is that if somebody says that's a sex reference, they're the perverts, you know? And so, like, what do you mean? You look at this line where they're describing a Y, like the letter Y, and you think, what? What is it you think? You dirty man.
Apparently an American film censor once complained that with Lubitsch, you know what he's saying, but you just can't prove he's saying it,
right?
Which is interesting. No, he's an interesting figure. The thing you mentioned there, Darren, about his autonomy, you know, because he's somebody who actually moved between studios quite a bit. I think he worked at Paramount for the longest period. In fact, what's interesting is, for a brief period, he was made the head of production at Paramount, but apparently didn't work out. But also, he'd worked at United Artists, Warner Brothers, MGM, 20th Century Fox, and his style changed a bit as he moved between studios. But arguably, then, he fits the idea of an auteur better than many other figures from old Hollywood, because he had that autonomy, which was quite rare at the time. Almost always had the right to final cut. I think on To Be or Not To Be, he had writer approval, cast approval, and final cut. I mean, there's probably a broader discussion there. You may have had it before. I'm not sure we've ever discussed it, but the idea about whether it's appropriate even to think about the idea of an auteur in such a restrictive system as old Hollywood. Or at all, in terms of filmmaking, because it's so collaborative, you know. But Lubitsch, of those older sort of figures, like I say, he had a lot of pull, which is interesting.
Well, I imagine part of it is the ego of the director, and to what extent that's kind of, you know, trampled down by the studio. And the second thing, like, these days, and perhaps back then, is marketing. Is it, you know, if it's going to make the studio money to kind of put his name out there and make him a star, but then it becomes more difficult to manage him.
From the visionary director, Ernest Lubitz.
Exactly. Yeah. But I guess I get the impression, like a lot of these older films, I mean, films these days, but a lot of these older films, I find myself noticing how much importance is given to the kind of production of it, like I think we've seen a few films so far where it's Selznick, and where it feels like the title cards are kind of telling you more about Selznick than about anything else, which would be, I guess, unusual in the in these days. It's kind of like, I make movies. I don't direct them.
Yeah.
Just somehow movies happen.
I just... Yeah. Yeah, and it's all from me. Yeah. I think we talked about this when we talked about, I think, The Wizard of Oz, which Salman Rushdie described as the authorless text, because it had, what, four or five, even six directors, depending on how you count them. And, like, the closest thing you had to a guiding light was the studio executive at the very top, which is kind of fascinating as well. But yeah, Lubitz is fascinating figure. And, like, even in the context of this, which we kind of alluded to, you mentioned that it began production a couple of weeks before the US entry into the war with Pearl Harbor. And again, I think I've seen conflicting reports whether it began shooting in October or November. But obviously, when it was filmed and when it was about to release, that was a huge fireball. And I kind of love, this is a great Lubitz story, where the studio apparently were very tetchy about it, and they looked at the title To Be or Not To Be, and they apparently thought that this wouldn't market well in rural areas. They're worried about, like, rural Americans seeing a line from Shakespeare and thinking that this would be a different kind of film instead of a Jack Benny film and Carol Lombard film, Queen of the Screwballs. So they were like, okay, can we change the name of this movie? And Lubitz, and I absolutely love this. Lubitz responds by writing a letter and CCing his stars and the press on it, announcing that, why, yes, I take on board the studio's United Artists reservations about this. I understand that this movie is too hot to be released in its current form. I would happily suggest that we change the title of this movie to The Censor Forbids. Sincerely, Ernest Lubitz. And then sat back and watched the fireworks as, like, Jack Benny and Carol Lombard were like, what are you trying to do, censor this movie that we're making? And United Artists going, whoa, 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 that wasn't what we were suggesting at all. And eventually kind of relenting and saying, okay, fine, you can call it To Be or Not To Be if you want.
No,
yeah.
Which I kind of
No censor could stop them.
Yeah. That's funny though, Darren, because I'd also come across another story that I don't think in relation to this film, but just about Lubitz generally, which was that small town exhibitors often complained that as good as his films were, they didn't appeal to their patrons because they were too sophisticated, you know, which is kind of interesting. Because I think the idea that of the Lubitz touch that you kind of mentioned, when it's normally associated with a sophisticated type of comedy, which is often about omission or ellipses, I think Francois Truffaut described Lubitz's style as Lubitz Swiss cheese. You know, it has all these holes in that the audience must fill themselves. I suppose one of the things that's interesting about that is, first of all, just the very term Lubitz touch, it suggests that he has this recognizable style, even as he's working in this highly codified system. But also what Peter Bogdanovich said was that the Lubitz touch was as famous a phrase in its day as calling Hitchcock the master of suspense, you know. And I don't think it feels like that now. It feels to me like Hitchcock is still much more well-known than Lubitz is. Is that fair, or is that just me projecting because I haven't seen as many of his films as I would like, you know?
No, absolutely. I'll speak as the person who knows least about movies. I hadn't heard of the Lubitz touch. I hadn't heard of this movie. I needed to look it up. I think that's fair. The idea of there being a Lubitz touch doesn't have the same currency, I guess. What do you reckon, Darren?
Well, no, like that's the thing, is that, like, it's been argued that, like, Lubitz was hugely influential at the time and inspired a generation of filmmakers who followed. Like, Billy Wilder very famously had a sign above his door reading, "How would Lubitz do it?"
Wow.
Like, that's how much he was kind of, how much he was influenced. Well, I mean, like, it goes even deeper than that. Like, this is not a spoiler for the film that we're discussing, but, like, there's a character in this movie called Colonel Earhart, who's played by an actor called Sig Ruman. And, you know, he's called Concentration Camp Earhart and has a whipping boy named Schultz. Schultz! However, when Billy Wilder was making Stalag 17, he cast Sig Ruman again as the Nazi sergeant inspecting the POW barracks, named Schultz. But, like, and you have this entire generation of kind of, like...
It's a funny thing, though, because, like, the audiences now are familiar with Billy Wilder. They're also familiar with people like Fritz Lang, who, like, you know, German directors who came over to America, kind of, and who... who are known. Is it that we don't value comedy? I mean, I know Billy Wilder is obviously kind of an exception to that, but there's a real lack of these sorts of movies in the list. And does it represent kind of that there's a difference between the movies that people say they like and the movies that they actually like? And all of a sudden,
maybe
because you know the public kind of opinion is that certain movies are better than others because they're
more serious or more earnest or more worthy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that Lubitsch is very much like defined by, you know, outside of this, things like romantic comedies. That's his big influence in Hollywood. Things like The Shop Around the Corner. Things like, you know, kind of that was it, the Touch of Paradise? Sorry, Trouble in Paradise.
Trouble in Paradise,
in 1932.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff is kind of like what defined him and was his kind of bread and butter. And yeah, there aren't a lot of those movies on the list. And we historically, I think, don't think of romantic comedies as a genre as worthy of others. Like when we did our Summer of 99 season, which, you know, wrapped up 3 weeks ago, I think, roughly. But like when we did that season, which is still ongoing, we talked
about things I had about you kept on coming up.
Yeah. And like didn't make the list, never made the list. We talked about how things like Clueless is a touchstone for many people, many young people of our generation, but never gets talked about in the same breath as Fight Club or The Matrix or those kind of movies, which are more...
In terms of like subversive teen movies, like they don't talk about Election either. Like
even though that's Alexander Payne, like that's a guy who's now regarded as an auteur, but like he didn't become an auteur until he started making movies like The Descendants or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Is this the only Lubitsch film in the IMDb list then? Or have others been in and out? Or...
I'll go you one better. This is the only Lubitsch film that has ever been in the list, which is kind of striking as well, and thought it was worth talking about. I do wonder, though, if it's also down to the fact that whereas like Fritz Lang is one of a kind, and I mean, you could argue that like maybe you can draw a line from him to Tim Burton, but like in terms of like as directors with distinct stylistic sensibilities, like Lang is of his own and in a class of his own, whereas if you were being generous and we were saying maybe it's the romantic comedy stuff and maybe it's something else, is it also that like Lubitsch was a clear influence on a generation of directors who maybe supplanted him in the consciousness? Like we mentioned Billy Wilder being a key student. We mentioned the fact that like, you know, Mel Brooks loved this movie so much that he went on and he remade it. And like Brooks doesn't have a movie in the 250, to be clear, but he has had three movies in the 250. He's had Blazing Saddles, The Producers, and what was
Young Frankenstein?
Young Frankenstein, yes. Thank you. Good guess, Andrew, and you're right. But yeah, but like, and again, those drop out because comedies aren't treated as seriously anyway. But I do wonder if with Lubitsch, it's a case of like, he was the original, but in public consciousness, when we think about movies that we would imagine as Lubitsch movies, we think about things like, say, The Producers instead when it comes to Nazi spoofs, or we think about...
Yeah, and also maybe the fact that his work in Germany is somewhat overlooked. You know, if it may be that they're a substantial part of his body of work, but it's generally the fact that the American films are what are discussed, aren't they? I think there is a good box set somewhere of his, some of his earlier films, but I wonder if that's part of it. I do think what you said there rings true. The fact that, I mean, obviously he's one of the most successful European migrants to go to Hollywood in the first half of the 20th century. And we've talked before, I think on Double Indemnity, we were talking about how figures like Wilder kind of enriched American cinema. But I think what you're saying sounds about right, that some of those figures like Wilder kind of supplanted him in the popular consciousness, which is a shame. At least this one's in there. That's good.
All right, then. So before we jump into the spoilers, on three questions to get us started. So, Carl, do you think To Be or Not to Be belongs on the list of the 250 greatest movies ever made?
I think that you could probably make a good claim for its greatness. I think it does feel to me like someone like Lubitsch should be on the list. So I think that would be a big part of the argument. I think it's a triumph for, like I said, Lombard and Jack Benny. I don't think is ever going to get near the list otherwise, you know. As a different kind of World War II film, I think it has an awful lot of merit. So I think there's a case for it. I'm not sure I can... It's hard for me because I've only seen it like 4 days ago. It takes me a while to sort of make my mind up on this kind of thing. I think there's a strong case for it, yeah.
And Andrew, what about yourself?
Yeah, I do. I think it has a lot to recommend itself. It's hilarious. Like I was kind of laughing out loud, like probably, I'd say at least 10 times, maybe. I didn't clock it.
That six laugh test.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it isn't just that either. I mean, it's a gorgeous movie. It's very well paced. It just zips. And I was amazed watching it because, not because I wasn't enjoying it, but because I was under pressure this morning. I was looking at the time and I was like, how are they going to get through all this stuff like in the next 10 minutes? Because like, this is not wrapped up. Like, they're not saying, all right, bye, everyone. You know, this isn't we haven't yet reached the kind of conclusion, but it's really very propulsive. I think the message of it is profound, yet kind of straightforward. I think you can enjoy it on a few different levels. It has that nice kind of quality that farces have, where it can be a little serpentine, or it can be fun to kind of figure out what's happening, but not too much, you know. So yeah, I do think this is a great example of a film. You know, if the idea was to take these 250 films and put them in a ship and send them into the furthest reaches of our galaxy.
As a representative of what film is.
Is that what the first question means?
Yeah. Yeah, no, the second question is Movie Island. The first question is Movie Pod.
Movie Voyager.
Movie Voyager, yeah. Movie Voyager 5. But yes, I would agree with that.
Voyager.
That's it. What would happen if Voyager got like to be or not to be instead and kind of moved its way back? Star Trek did have a couple of Nazi episodes, to be fair. So there probably was a planet that received a copy of To Be or Not to Be and kind of interpreted in the wrong way. But no.
Yeah, I would, like in Star Trek, when they're like, what are we going to do? And in the writer's room, it's like, do you want to do another Nazi thing? Like, yes! It's been ages.
We did a gangster planet. We did a Roman planet. Do you think we can do... I think we can fit in a Nazi planet. And it's great because all those things happen in like a compressed period of time at the end of the second season. So there's a real sense of what the hell are we doing this week? Planet of the gangsters. There we go. That's it. And the thing is, I would argue all three of those are great. But this is not a Star Trek podcast. That is a separate podcast.
Sorry, I shouldn't get you started, Dan.
I know, sorry.
I felt like just wound you up
and let me waddle across the table like a wind-up penguin. But that's a different movie. That's the movie we covered last week. But what I will say is, yeah, I would agree with actually, I think both of you said it very well, which is I think there is an argument to be made for it being there in terms of cultural importance. I think we mentioned the producers. I don't imagine you get the producers without this, to be frank. I also... And I think Tarantino's been frank about this. You don't get Inglourious Basterds without this.
Yeah.
And I think Verhoeven has also, like, I don't know if he's admitted it, but I think it's very obvious you don't get Black Book if you don't without this as well.
Do you think we'd get Jojo Rabbit without this? I mean, I'd be happy with not having Jojo Rabbit personally, but what do you think? Because that mix of kind of, you know.
The Heil Hitler kind of joke and the skewering. By the way, Verhoeven is... He directed RoboCop, didn't he? Sorry.
Yeah, I set you up there, Andrew. Obligatory RoboCop reference.
I beg your pardon. I didn't get in quite at it, but I was thinking I'm going to have to do that later on. I've derailed the podcast enough.
you mean the only Best Picture nominee from last year, Carl, that didn't make
this list. It didn't make the 250.
Is that right?
Justice has been done in some way. They do borrow the Hail Myself that joke, isn't that? They use that in. They just use that in Jojo Rabbit.
Sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, like I haven't seen Jojo Rabbit, but I've seen kind of little clips, I guess, where I think maybe Steve Martin did something where he talked about his performance or where Taika Waititi talked about a scene or something. It features like a lot of the kind of same jokes. But and I haven't seen Jojo Rabbit, and I don't want to give away too... Well, I've already said it's one of the top 250 movies ever made. And Jojo Rabbit...
clearly isn't.
So, this is better, and it tells the joke better, too. It had plenty of time to go back and like recut the joke, and it's like, this is going to be just like To Be or Not to Be, but even better. But instead, it was like, what are we doing?
70 years to work on the joke, and that's what you had. I do like, by the way, that Andrew says it's like Jojo Rabbit isn't one of the 250 greatest movies ever. Like, it's some sort of damning insult.
I like Taika Waititi, by the way. I love Taika Waititi. I know he's a fan. So
yeah, he does listen. He's very enthusiastic. No. He's going to be in our mentions after this.
Imagine if he did listen. Like, he definitely doesn't. He's too many things to be doing.
Yeah. All right. And Carl, would it be on your own personal 250, having only seen it 4 days ago?
Well, I did think it was genuinely laugh out loud funny. I thought it blended in the more serious elements effectively. I think the ideas it's playing with are quite weighty. And I felt they were treated in an appropriate way. Although, as you've alluded to already, Darren, that wasn't how a lot of critics felt at the time. I do think it's a very interesting approach. Take some of the heaviest subject matter you can think of and treat it comically. I can see why people would be uneasy about that in principle. But I think it gets across the seriousness of the situation whilst also making you laugh. And that's no mean feat. Would it be one of my favourites? I'm going to say no at this stage, just purely because it takes me a while. I only saw it this week. I could see it becoming a favourite. Having watched it a couple of times, I can see it being a film I watch again. And it may be that it does take its place in my list of favourites eventually. So I think there's potential there.
And Andrew, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think it's got quite a good shot. I think it does a better job than Brooks in the producers. I mean, it's a difficult thing to do because, like, if you're doing a funny movie about Nazis, then do you put in a scene which shifts the tone,
makes them threatening?
Yeah, and or do you just kind of make a satire and say it's not only tragic that this happened, it's stupid, you know? I think that's kind of the way the movie goes. And there is pathos in it, but it's not it's not trying to kind of ram it down your throat, or like at the expense of, it doesn't feel tokenistic or kind of like that like, oh, now we have to kind of, you know, change tone. It all feels fairly kind of authentic, and I like the approach. Now, it's not for me to say, other people might find it offensive, and that's fine too.
We should mention that, like, we'll probably talk about this more on the other side, but, like, in terms of the genre shift, that was a hugely controversial thing for critics at the time, and it was something that I think that kind of Lubitsch himself kind of talked about and had to defend in articles that he wrote.
Very jarring.
Yeah, it is. It's striking.
I did not know what this movie was. I was watching it with another person, and they were like, is this a comedy? Sorry.
And you're like, I guess. Maybe. I'm not entirely sure. Like, I don't know.
I didn't want to say straight away.
Yeah. But like, it is like the cinematography was done by Rudolf Matte, who apparently shot it in the same way that he shot like Alfred Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent from 1940. So it, like, there are times where it is shot. The visual language of it is, this is an espionage thriller. And then there's other parts of it where it's like, no, this is very similar to The Producers.
I think that makes it better, though.
Mm.
I feel like a lot of there are different kind of theories of humor, and it's like, why is there a theory of humor? It's either funny or it's not. But one kind of theory is that it's kind of incongruity. So it's you shoot something serious, and you have people playing things straight as well, but what they're saying isn't.
Yeah.
Is absurd.
Is absurd. Are you like, sorry, I was going to come up with some examples, but people know what I mean. Yeah.
You mean the entire cinematography of Paul Verhoeven, for example, the director of RoboCop?
No, I was going to say the Armstrong and Miller sketch, where there's two World War II pilots, which we have in this movie. And where they're talking about being World War II pilots, but they're talking like teenagers. They're like, and I just smashed into this tree. Like, I was like, shut up. No, I did. And it was like all like exploded and everything. And yeah. where that's kind of, you know, it's in black and white, and they're wearing the uniforms, and they look like British air pilots in a World War II movie.
Yeah.
and they're talking about that stuff, but the hilarity is that, like, you kind of get used to people talking like teenagers, but you put it in another context, and you're like, yeah. Sorry.
In terms of why
that's the kind of thing I mean.
In terms of why things are funny, I think there's the idea that Lubitsch's films, which are predominantly comedies, they have this sort of tenderness of heart, but it's based on very humane values, you know, because he tends to be lampooning the powerful, tends to be quite sympathetic to underdogs and outsiders. I think, like, the women in his films are often powerful, sexually aggressive, for instance. The men, by contrast, quite timid and passive. But I think in terms of this film, Jewishness is quite important to that, isn't it? Because it seems like Jewish humor is informed by that long history of oppression that Jewish people have suffered, and that wit becomes something of a weapon that can be wielded against the people oppressing them, you know.
It's a recurring motif, isn't it, that the joke about Hitler. Like, there's like a recurring story thread in here that has nothing to do with the main plot, about a joke that's going round Warsaw about Hitler.
And interestingly as well, the word Jew is never uttered in the film, is it? Which maybe we can discuss in the spoiler zone. Yeah.
Yes, because there's a lot in there that's codified as Jewish, but it's not explicitly mentioned, I think, as well. And for myself, probably, actually, which is quite something on a movie that I've literally just watched. I think we talked on, when I've been on the Movie Palace before, the weird irony of being on the Movie Palace, in that I am sometimes maybe not as affectionate for the kind of era of Code Era Hollywood as a lot of people are.
You only started watching movies in 2011.
Before that, I never existed.
When you became, you were asked to be a critic, and then you were like, I guess I gotta watch
all these movies. Well, no, that's the thing.
That's you watched X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yes, which was the first movie I reviewed as a critic, which is striking. That's in the
Darren. So anything pre X-Men Origins Wolverine,
it's in cinema.
Darren, though, is that mild disdain for old Hollywood? Is that because of the code? The idea that the code is, you know, definitionally sexist, racist, homophobic, you know, is that part of it?
Okay, well, I will push back on mild disdain. Mild disdain makes it sound like a much stronger emotion. I think it's more that Andrew, I think, repeatedly on this, Andrew has at several points this podcast compared me to Garth Marenghi, and I'm going to own that now in this moment. I've written more books than I've read, I think you said at one point, for example.
I don't mean that.
I mean,
you read lots of books. They just have pictures in them.
That's a very fair point. But what I was going to say was, I'm going to own that. And it's the, you know, I know writers who use subtext and they're all cowards. I think one of my big issues with kind of like 40s era, a kind of Code Era production, is that it pushes a lot of interesting stuff to the margins or underneath instead of talking about it. And you know, I wouldn't be so strong as to say kind of like racist, sexist, homophobic, but I do think that, like, putting those explicitly outside the frame and leaving them only there by inference does rob a lot of stuff that you could talk about. I find earlier stuff more interesting. I find, you know, stuff that was happening in Europe in the 1950s more interesting. And I am, like, every terrible film person online, a big fan of New Hollywood. You know, I own those things. But I actually, that's what I was going to say, is that I really, really loved this. And I think that maybe it's that Lubitsch touch, that thing that I didn't know existed until I started doing research for this podcast. But that ability to sneak so much in around the kind of restrictions that exist. And because it's a comedy and because it's a thriller, it manages to do all of that remarkably well with incredible deft and grace. It is, like, really, really funny. I laughed out loud repeatedly. I don't know if I laughed 10 times because I don't count my laughs. I'm not that much of a robot. But I did laugh repeatedly. There are some brilliant one-liners in here. But also watching it, I was like, I would have difficulty believing that you could get away with some of this stuff in a studio film today, let alone in 1942.
Yeah.
In particular, the line that caused so much controversy in reviews, which we might get to in the spoiler zone. But yeah, sorry, Andrew.
Yeah, but the reason it wouldn't get past, it wouldn't get made, sorry, I'm going to be very cynical and say, like, it wouldn't get made today, but not because of, like, moral concerns. It wouldn't get made because of money. Because presumably, if it was a satire, it would be saying something important about something that's happening in the world. And I don't think Hollywood would let that.
I think.
Well, sorry, no. Obviously, there's plenty of exceptions, and there's great Hollywood movies getting made which are, you know, speaking to the moment that we're in. But there are certain things that you don't talk about in Hollywood, I guess.
And World War II, while
we covered Kundun.
Yeah. Things you can't talk about in Hollywood anymore. Yes.
I think what's interesting about this film in particular is it was quite a daring undertaking, because I think after 1933, most Hollywood studios were trying to de-emphasize Jewish characters and stories. You know, even American anti-Nazi films during wartime were rarely referencing the plight of European Jews that overtly, you know. I think you had this situation where the studios were trying to face both ways, which is a trend throughout Hollywood history, I think, where they were trying to align with the policy of the Allies whilst also not attracting the ire of anti-Semites, you know. It kind of reminds me how you get things today, like the Star Wars films try to include same-sex representation with couples kissing or whatever, but in such a way that you can cut it out so that it can be shipped to China, you know, that kind of thing, where you're trying to face both ways.
I think Mayer's argument was that, like, Louis B. Mayer argued, like, despite being a Jewish man himself, his argument was that he didn't want to draw attention to the fact that the studios were run by Jewish people, because he was worried about not necessarily even, like, German markets, but the idea of, like, Americans being realizing that, oh my God, this industry is controlled by Jewish people, and what the reaction would be. So his idea was to just avoid it entirely and not bring it up and pretend that it was never happening, which is stunning.
That whole trope of such and such an industry being run by the Jews, like, it often happens because Jewish people are excluded from other industries.
Yeah.
And then there's all this panic when it's like, oh, they're bankers and jewelers. It's like, well, that wasn't considered a Christian thing to do. So that's what they were kind of relegated to, because they weren't allowed into guilds.
Movies weren't considered, like, an art form, like, so that's why you ended up with so much influence there. It's like, oh yeah, but now they are, so we should be worried about it.
Exactly. And there's it always becomes this thing where it's like those how mendacious of them to go into and one of the few industries that they were allowed to kind of, anyway, sorry.
I was just gonna say that in terms of war films or films about the Jewish experience during the wartime, I think Chaplin's The Great Dictator is a good counterexample. But his film existed in a more purely comic form than Lubitsch's, I think, which, as we've said, kind of blends in these dramatic elements too.
Plus, he was a communist.
And predated the war as well.
And what, sorry?
And predated the war. As well,
yeah, actually. The Great Dictator.
Oh, and as Andrew said, he was a communist. Sorry, that was Andrew's observation.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I beg your pardon. No, didn't it release a little late? That it's kind of like...
The Great Dictator was 1940.
So it predated American entry into the war. Like, that was one of the reasons why Chaplin was considered... One of the reasons why Chaplin was considered a communist, as you pointed out there, was that he was prematurely anti-fascist, which is a stunning thing to, like, exist in American public consciousness in the 50s.
Right.
He was against Hitler, but he was against Hitler before the country was against Hitler. Therefore, he was sympathetic to communism. Therefore, he was a traitor in our midst, which is stunning. That's a separate discussion for people far more qualified than me to delve into. But yeah, that amazes me.
But it's a funny thing as well in America, because there became this sort of reckoning in the 40s and 50s to separate New Deal progressives from communists, like you know fellow travelers and people who supported the Allies, the USSR during the war, from foreign agents who've been sent to kind of undermine democracy. And I don't think people were terribly fussed whether, like, you know, guilty people, or sorry, whether innocent people were found guilty. Mm-hmm. Anyway, like, I suppose we're not saying anything new.
But, the hottest news from 1956, is what we have here today.
yeah. Here's our hot take.
McCarthyism, questionable at best.
Anti-Semitism, wrong.
And then, so to round up, final question then. If listeners have not seen To Be or Not To Be, Carl, would you recommend that they pause the podcast, go out and stream it? It is available, I think, on Criterion in the States. Don't know if it's available on BFI in the UK.
I had to buy a Korean version DVD, which you surprised me. It surprised me how difficult the film was to find, actually. I think there may have been an earlier DVD release that was out of print, but I couldn't find that. Just to jump back to something we were saying earlier, I do think the code was racist and sexist, by the way, because I think the idea of sexual deviancy, which included things like homosexuality, means that. So
yeah,
I'll just chuck that in. Doesn't mean I don't like the Hollywood era. I do think that's worth acknowledging. Yes, I would recommend people go and watch the film. I think this podcast will have much less entertainment value if people haven't seen the film we're discussing. I think it might have some entertainment value if they have seen it. Yeah, it might be, I think it's worth the effort. Like I said, I had to battle to find it, but really glad I did.
We will put all our ads in the pre-roll, so it doesn't matter if they listen to the rest of it.
And Andrew, what about yourself? Would you recommend that people watch To Be or Not To Be?
Yeah, I would. I would. Absolutely. I didn't know it existed. I feel like I've already said too much because I had the joy of turning this on and not knowing what it was, being surprised and finding it very funny and of having no expectations of it, which is so precious. So yes, watch it before listening to what we've said already. I'd recommend people.
Just hit refresh on your memory, your short-term memory.
Do that Men in Black thing, but be careful because that can go wrong.
And also just write down need to watch To Be or Not To Be before doing it, otherwise it's a certain purpose.
The movie.
Not Mel Brooks. Underline. And I would kind of third that recommendation as well. Make it three of a kind there. Yeah, this was a joy. First time watching it this week for this podcast. And yeah, fantastic. Loved it. Well worth your time. With that in mind, then we'll segue neatly into the spoiler zone.
Spoiler zone.
So, Carl, what is To Be or Not To Be about for you?
So, in a nutshell, the film is about a group of Polish actors who impersonate Gestapo officers to save themselves and the Polish underground. So, appropriately then, I think it's a film about performance, because obviously in the sense that it's about actors, also in the sense that there's a broader emphasis on the idea of acting, I think. It comes with the idea that there's this kind of porousness between what represents real life or reality and what represents the illusion of acting. So I think we see things in the film like the discussion about what type of acting is appropriate for a play about the Nazis in the early scenes of the film. We get actors playing at being Nazis, both in real life and on stage, and they go on to fool the real thing. We see performed versions of real characters sometimes before we meet the real thing. So I think we see the impression of Colonel Earhart that Jack Benny does before we meet the character himself.
And fake Hitler before real Hitler. And you don't even see real Hitler's face. You just see the back of real
Hitler. You see him from behind, don't you? Yeah. I think that emphasis on simulation is appropriate for Lubitsch, because I believe he was sort of famous as an actor's director. Like, for instance, I think he helped turn... There's a Polish actress, Pola Negri, and he made her helped her become an international star. And he was known for acting out scenes for his performers to show them exactly what he expected and wanted. So, yeah, I think it's about acting as part of the way it comically approaches Nazism, I think.
The title as well, and the kind of the way kind of structurally it starts and finishes is with Hamlet works as well, because of the play within the play aspect from that as well being mirrored in the film itself. So I wonder how much of that. It must be intentional. Like the way it structurally works, the way some scenes are repeated as well, is wonderful. Where we have like the crime line version of it, and then we have the real, and it's hilarious when there is kind of callbacks as well.
They call me Concentration Camp Earhart.
That's very funny.
The joke about Hitler. Like it opens with like Jack Benny playing Earhart, hearing the joke about Hitler, and then you get later on that same scene playing out again, and literally the same beat for beat stuff, where it's like, "Oh, you're not going to tell him, are you?" Like literally, like frame for frame, which is stunning.
The funniest thing for me about that scene was about how awkward, and because that he's playing a character and that he doesn't have lines. So he's just awkwardly saying this line over and over again. But then when you play it again, you realize, oh, people do that. You know, that's like a normal thing for a person to do when they don't have anything to say. They just, you know, make inane small talk and repeat things they've already heard.
And laugh to fill the silence. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think part of what's so funny about that is that as hammy as those protagonists can be, they've actually got nothing on the Nazis, really, because we see that very funny approximation of the colonel. And yeah, it's just the idea that he runs out of dialogue so quickly is very funny to me. But then when we meet Earhart, we realize that actually he had a pretty good handle on the part. If anything, he was kind of underplaying it, you know, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, Earhart is somehow more of a caricature than Jack Benny playing Earhart, which is remarkable as well. To bring it back to Hamlet, actually, just because obviously that's the title of the movie and the you know, it's kind of framed with performances of Hamlet and stuff like that. And again, one of the big jokes for audiences, and we'll probably come back to talking about Benny kind of later on because Benny's a fascinating character, but one of the big jokes for audiences watching this in 1942 was the idea of Jack Benny playing Hamlet, which is comparable to Jerry Seinfeld playing Hamlet, to get a kind of a sense of how weird this must have looked to audiences. Yeah. But like one of the things that, you know, in the, I think the 18th century, one of the big criticisms of Hamlet was that it did not adhere to Aristotle's kind of unities. And it was that it blended comedy and tragedy, and farce and tragedy, in a way that did not conform to Aristotle's kind of poetics. And, you know, Hamlet being generally regarded as one of the greatest works in the English language and art and literature and the history of culture, maybe it's a bit arrogant to invoke it when talking about a screwball comedy from 1942, but I do think that there is something clever in the idea, in the idea that this is similar in that it's taking something tragic and playing it kind of comedically, as opposed to what's almost the inverse in Hamlet, where you have like things like the play and kind of the sense in which, you know, kind of all the weird stuff that happens in Hamlet, you know?
We don't take Aristotle's distinctions in the poetics as seriously on the 250. We made a decision at the beginning.
That we weren't going to adhere to the poetic unity. Yep, that's...
Yeah.
I think my favorite moment about the Hamlet stuff, though, is when he first comes on stage and the guy beneath the stage is like whispering, "To be or not to be," you know, probably the most famous passage of dialogue in any play ever. You know, and he needs a prompt. There's a book on the film by Peter Barnes, who's a dramatist, and he says that a lot of the theatrical detail in the film is accurate. He's pointing to things like how, you know, the guy playing Hitler comes in and adds the line, "Hail myself," you know. And they have that discussion with the director, and the director says, "So what's your line? Or what does it say?" He says, "Nothing." "Well, say nothing." He says that kind of interplay is very kind of apropos, he says. I think the screenwriter, I think Lubitsch is interesting because apparently he had no problem with writers. He enjoyed working with good writers, which means he contrasts with someone like Hitchcock, who often had complicated relationships with his writers. But the screenwriter here, Edwin Justus Mayers, he was a playwright. He had extensive knowledge of the theatre, so it means you don't get like an outsider's view of the theatre. And of course, it goes with that theme of the idea of everything, life and politics and Nazism. It's all some form of show business, you know.
And I mean, even things like, say, and again, the way in which the theater kind of collapses into reality and reality kind of collapses outwards. So like you have the sequence where they're trying to fool kind of Stiletsky and they take him into the set dress office. And that looks like a kind of a commandant's office, and he's being interviewed there, colonel's office is being interviewed there, but he escapes into the theater. And you have this it's an amazing sequence because it's inside a theater, but it's like a prison break sequence from something like The Great Escape, where you have them like walking through rows looking for him, like they're hunting him in tall grass, for example, or he runs out on stage and they put the spotlight on him again, it's a prison break. And I love that, and we'll probably come back to this in terms of tone. Like, this is a spoof and a farce, but it's a farce where people die and there are real stakes. So let's see, gets like shot and killed. And he gets shot and killed on the set from Hamlet, which is quite striking as well. And again, it's all very, and then becomes part of the scenery. You discover later they apparently just stuffed his body into a piece on the set, a piece of set, which is remarkable as well.
Well, I mean, in Paris, and this is what I don't know. Is this a stretch? I mean, Darren, you'll definitely tell me. But when we were talking about Hamlet, I'm kind of wondering. In Paris, is this a kind of a safe way of playing out a Jewish revenge fantasy, like Inglourious Basterds or like Munich. Yeah. And I mean, obviously Munich is based on real events, but that idea of kind of exorcising or like processing yeah. the anger felt about what happened and what happened through collaborators who may still be alive as well.
I think you can sort of read Greenberg character, who's played by Felix Bressart, as almost the hero of the piece.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Because he's fourth build, I think, Jewish.
Isn't he? He's like, he's fourth build, despite arguably not having that much to do. He arguably features less than, say, Tom Duggan as Bronski playing Hitler, for example.
But he has a very pivotal role, I think, and he's the most overtly Jewish character. Apparently this is Liebich's first American film with an overtly Jewish character, which is interesting. There are other characters that are maybe implicitly Jewish. Like, I think you can read Benny's character that way, because Benny's real name was Benny Kubelski. He's been called a classic Schlemiel kind of archetype. But I think his Jewish identity remained more covert for mainstream audiences. But Greenberg has been considered Lubitsch's mouthpiece, apparently, because he plays the kind of minor role. He's just one of the spear carriers, isn't he? He plays that kind of minor role that Lubitsch had played in the theatre 30 years earlier in Berlin. He recites Shylock's famous speech from The Merchant of Venice, I think, 3 times during the course of the film, which is a speech.
It's very powerful as well.
It is, yeah. And it's a speech Lubitsch had performed at an audition in the 1910s that got him into the Max Reinhardt theatre troupe. He makes that joke, Greenberg, doesn't he, about, like I say, he's never explicitly referred to as Jewish, but there's that ham actor played by Lionel Atwill, and he says, "What you are, I couldn't eat," you know. but yeah, I think it's nice, because he accomplishes his dream of playing Shylock, which leads to the Polish resistance being saved. So actually that speech is edited, because in the Shakespeare play, it contains the word Jew. In this film, it doesn't. But Greenberg is clearly Jewish, and then he disappears from the film. So maybe that's an example of Lubitsch's tendency to omit unusual things. But I think you can still sort of see him as the hero, or one of them.
And hilarious, like, kind of, for the audience, it's obvious. But, like, in case it's not obvious, there's this scene at the end where he comes out of a door and just... And everybody sees him, and they immediately, like, jump to the same conclusion. And it is insane how that can be played for laughs, but it is hilarious. It's a very funny gag.
And again, like you mentioned, the fact it's done 3 times, it's that thing that you like. It's how wonderfully you talked about, like, this is a farce, and it is incredibly funny. It moves incredibly nimbly. Andrew was right when he said before the spoiler zone, it has a lot of plot. It's a very heavily plotted farce as well, and it just moves
most
so
farces are like the like all kind of what
comedies
verism stuff. Like a lot of stuff. Sorry,
have you heard the François Truffaut quote about the plot, which is, he said, "I could challenge you, for example, to recount the plot of To Be or Not to Be an hour after having seen it, even if it were for the 6th time, impossible," you know, which I don't know. I had no problem following it, but I kind of know what he means.
That's totally fair. Like, and with a lot, and I like a movie with a kind of a, I guess, what would you say, serpentine plot, and I like trying to figure it out, and I don't mind if once the movie is over, I've figured out the plot and I'm wrong, you know, or if I can't quite remember it, because it's about the experience when watching it, I guess.
I would agree with that. I think that, like, I think in terms of how well structured it is, you get like a lot of things where they're introduced. I think Carl mentioned this, introduced as comedies or as jokes. So the idea of like Hitler and he's in Warsaw and it's hilarious. And then it's like, oh, by the way, Warsaw is now demolished after the Nazis arrived. You get that contrast there. Yeah. You get things like, again, that the sequence is played with Earhart, and it's like, you know, it's a spoof scene, and it's like, oh, we're in a theater performing a play, and that's like life and death. And the way in which even that speech, that kind of like famous Shylock speech, like, it's introduced as, well, you know, I'm an actor who dreams of having a moment on the stage carrying a spear, and it's kind of silly that I dream of this big Shakespearean soliloquy while wearing this silly hat and carrying this spear. And then the next time you see it, they're clearing out the rubble, and it becomes sadder, And then they play it again the third time, and it's even more tense because, and more dramatic and more earned because it's the climax of the movie as well.
And it's the and whole I like point that, of it, though.
That
of that soliloquy. Yeah. That and that I can't help but think, and maybe this is naive, but even they kind of, the crowd that is gathered, how they couldn't be moved by it. And realize the essential truth of that there is, and this is going to sound facile, but that there is one race, there's the human race, and that's like because I think people take it for granted now, like the I guess how much intolerance there is, and some of it's very small. But that this whole idea of people being different or other, where if you prick them, do they not bleed? And if you tickle them, do they not laugh? Like we're sorry, yeah.
No, I think that's interesting in terms of the way the Nazis are depicted as well, because I think
yes. There
are a couple of key moments here for me. So one is when. I think it's a very funny moment, but it's when Earhart says that he signs so many orders of execution that he can't be expected to remember every single one, you know. And then he says later comment that what Chura did to Shakespeare, it's when Chura's actually in front of him dressed as Sieletzky, I think. What Chura did to Shakespeare, the Nazis are doing now to Poland. And I think that second comment in particular has been accused of being in bad taste, but I think they get to the heart of the matter in a very perceptive way, because you get the sense from the Nazis in this film that they're evil in very unimpressive ways. You know, I think the idea that the Nazis lack grace and politeness is kind of a big sin for somebody like Lubitsch, who made his name with these sophisticated comedies, you know, where it's all about style and glittering surfaces and things. So I think the approach he takes, where you've got this vaudeville-inflected comedy, which I think is hilariously funny at times, is appropriate, because that's a nice way to deflate sort of vanity and bullying. And what I like about the portrayal of the Nazis is they're not kind of placed over there in the way that Nazis often are in films. You know, they're often presented as being behind, you know, beyond the boundaries of what human behavior is. And sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes.
Well, they're like amoral and stupid. So even the characters who aren't stupid, like Sieletzky, he has very kind of simple ideas and doesn't really seem to appreciate like the whole, you know, moral space. And she skewers it wonderfully by is saying, oh, but what are we going to do about my conscience? Because he's saying, there's two sides in this. There's the right side. And you know it's the right side because we're winning.
Because it wins, yes. Because that's how you know it's the right side. I mean, like this is kind of interesting because this gets at what Carl was saying there about. It's notable that the movie parallels that Shylock speech, that kind of like "Prickos, do we not bleed?" speech, with a similar speech from Sieletzky himself when he's kind of pitching himself to Maria.
Do I look like a monster?
Yeah, we're just like other people. We love to sing. We love to dance. We admire beautiful women. We're human, and sometimes very human. And again, I think Carl's right. Like, movies about Nazis tend to be like, these are inhuman monsters. They're, you know, like Green Room is basically a monster movie with neo-Nazis playing the monsters in it, to pick an example. But like, there's lots of examples across history of that. And I think it's interesting that like, even though, and Andrew's right to point out that they are like, the Nazis are boorish, they're stupid, they're very driven by base desires, but
and
most of the other... Amoral. That's it. It's the amorality is the big difference, because I would argue that, like, you know, Joseph Tura, the Jack Benny character, is just as vain, just as stupid, just as self-interested, but he has a moral spine to him. That kind of.
I think this is it. I think, yeah, because Sieletzky's like the urbane face of Nazism, and he kind of justifies it. But he also hits one of the key ideas in another line. He says, in real life, it's even more important that you choose the right side. So I think it's an emblematic line. It's just ironic that it's coming from him, because it gets to that idea that if we're all playing a part to some extent, like I say, and I think the film's in large part about the performances we give in both life and in theatre. But if we're all playing a part, what's really important is your reasons for taking on those parts that you're choosing to play, you know. So I think it's powerful. I think Lubitsch has talked about how, I think he said, despite being farcical, To Be or Not to Be was a truer picture of Nazism than was shown by most novels, magazine stories, and pictures which deal with the same subject. I think I've also seen a quote from him. He felt that the so-called underground spirit amongst the German people never really existed and was kind of a fiction, basically. So,
and
yeah,
it's the kind of office politics of it, and the like the kind of stupid people in charge, I guess. Because he's like, how did you let him get away? Why didn't you arrest him? Go out and arrest everybody. And then he comes back and he's like, why are you arresting everybody? Stop arresting so many people. Why'd you kill those people? And he's giving them orders. And then when they say like, oh, you gave the order, it's like, oh, you're shifting the responsibility. Kind of, yeah.
Which is somewhat ironic given, you know, what would happen after the war, where you'd have the discussion about like, and again, there's a lot in this movie that reads somewhat ironically given what would happen in the years that followed. But I do think it's notable. Yes. Yeah, so to bring it back to Seletsky, like, I would argue Seletsky is the most developed Nazi character. And obviously, he dies around, say, the two-third mark, and then you have Earhart moving into the antagonistic role. But Seletsky, for most of the movie, is the embodiment of Nazism. He's the guy who gets to make the argument, as it were, for Nazism philosophically. He's the guy who gets the big speeches. And he never wears a Nazi uniform. He doesn't wear that distinctive kind of Nazi uniform that you expect a Nazi to wear. And he's presented as urbane and cultured and sophisticated. And he's well liked as well. Charming and kind of like and debonair. And I kind of like I like yeah.
By, I mean, by all you know, of you, the kind of
the Polish airmen.
Yeah.
You do get that small scene that kind of hints at it, where he's not singing along with them when they're talking about like dropping bombs on Hitler. And by the way, I do like that scene where they're all singing, the RAF boys are singing about dropping bombs on Hitler, kind of gets at the importance of performativity, which we'll come back to. Because there's a lot in this movie, I think, about like how important it is to be able to laugh at these things, as horrible as they are, in order to like remain human, or in order to like process these terrible things that are happening around you.
Yeah.
But I do think that like making Seletsky a very human character is a very conscious choice that kind of stands to the movie's credit, particularly at a time when you would imagine movies that are being designed for, you know, propagandist purposes would want to present the Nazis as this faceless, monstrous enemy horde that need to be eliminated or destroyed. And they're nothing like us. There's nothing in them that resembles anything that we quantify or codify as humanity. I find it fascinating the movie goes, actually, no, they are human. And that's why they're terrifying. They're just humanity without any of that cumbersome morality or conscience. That we associate, that yeah, we kind of,
because it's a sort of the it's this sort of scientism that marked a lot of the 20th century, where they like trying to you know, social Darwinism, taking an idea of the Enlightenment, kind of like and pushing it into politics. And the whole idea of that being kind of like one has their kind of ideas of human decency and, you know, solidarity and, you know, the precepts kind of that we would have associated with maybe religion, but it's not scientific. Kind of so there was a lot of kind of extremism in the 20th century that claimed kind of objectivity, and of course objectivity is not the greatest capacity of man or of humankind.
I think the stuff with Seletsky also speaks to the film's blend of styles and genres, doesn't it? Because I think he's introduced in the more sort of serious portions of the film. I think what Lubitsch said was that he was tired of the fact that the two main recipes were you could do a drama with some comedy relief, or you could do a comedy with some dramatic relief. And he didn't want to relieve anybody from anything, is what he said. You know, be dramatic when the situation demands it, be funny when that's called for. And he said, you could call it a tragical farce or a farcical tragedy. He didn't care, neither did the audience. But I wonder if that's part of what makes the film, or made the film, difficult for critics of the time to appreciate. I wonder if that kind of discombobulated some of those people who didn't like it on first release, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that quote from him. I think that quote from him came from a New York Times rebuttal.
It's an article, isn't
it? Yeah, an article he wrote for the New York Times explicitly responding to the criticism of his movie, because when it came out shortly after America joined the war, and people were like, what the hell is this? This is in terrible taste. This is horrible. Why would you make a movie like this? His response was, I was sick and tired of, as you pointed out, it's either a comedy or a thriller. It has to be one or the other. There has to be this firm delineation between the two. And I like, one of the things watching it I really liked is that it manages to blend the two. And I think like this is one of the interesting things in terms of theme, because you mentioned it's about performativity and you mentioned it's about acting. And like on the 250, a recurring trope that we keep going back to is that Hollywood loves making movies about how important acting is as a profession and how important like filmmaking and storytelling is as a profession. And it absolutely is, but you know, sometimes it feels like the emphasis on it is disproportionate. One of the things that I actually like about To Be or Not To Be is that while it is definitely about that, in that like it's very definitely about the importance of the arts and the importance of acting and the importance of performance, it's also not just about that, in that it's made very clear that in order for these people to like save the Polish underground and to save Poland and save Warsaw, it isn't enough that they make jokes of the Nazis. It isn't enough that they outwit them using their skills as performers. It's made very clear consistently that they are going to have to kill Selecki. And it's also made very clear that like the work that they are doing is significantly less important than the work that the actual underground is doing, actually destroying the Nazi infrastructure. And again, the idea that you have the Robert Stack character, who would be the protagonist in you know, a much more serious war film as well, but that he shows up and he gets to kill Selecki. He's the guy who shoots Selecki with his revolver as well. And the idea that like, this is just one facet. You don't, because like, yeah, I'm sorry, this is one where Darren gets on a kind of a soapbox or whatever. Like the past couple of years have been very interesting to watch, because you have this big discussion about like the role of comedy and the role that comedy plays in politics and in discourse and in defeating bad ideas that do terrible things and hurt people. And the idea that if you mock something, that diminishes its power and takes it away. And it does to an extent, but there are limits, and it can feel trite to say.
If you do it well, is key maybe.
And I think there's
a lot of bad faith in the contemporary argument about like, oh, get politics out of my comedy, and it's like, is it just that it's not the kind of politics you like? Whereas kind of like, I think some of those arguments go away when the comedy is actually funny.
But I do also think though that like you have things like the idea of, and again, sorry to date the podcast, but things like, say, you know, Donald Trump, and the idea that a lot of people are like, look, if you keep mocking him and if you turn him into a joke, he can't win. He can't come close to winning a second time. He can't enact his policy. He can't reshape the political party around him. If you reduce him to a joke, you will defeat him that way. And that is not what happened at all. And we can argue, you know, about whether or not it was a problem that the comedy just wasn't good or whatever. But I do find it interesting that, like,
I say some of it was not good.
Yeah,
more concern with kind of like speaking to an audience who've already made their mind up about Trump, and less concerned with being funny
and reaching other people and reaching out and stuff.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But I do find it in, like, I think it speaks very well to To Be or Not To Be, that it doesn't fall back on the trite, well, look, we can defeat the Nazis by laughing at them line. It understands that, like, laughing at them and exposing them and kind of mocking them and interrogating them has value and worth and is worth doing and is worthy of a subject of itself. But it doesn't pat itself on the back and say, well, job done. Thank goodness we kind of mock them.
I liked well how it undercut the Hollywood's love affair with itself in terms of, you had the character Sabinski, who's going to the theater every night and assumes that kind of like his knowledge of theater is that his knowledge of theater is the public's knowledge of theater, and the actors as well always assume the same thing. So he goes over to England and he's like, this guy Seletsky, he'd never heard of Maria Jura. It's like, we haven't heard of him either. And it's like, yeah, but that would be very strange in Poland for anybody not to have heard of. And he's kind of taking it for granted that, like, this guy Sabinski, he's on film Twitter and he's having a conversation with like
about Ernest
Joe
Lubitz.
Public. Exactly. And
just on the idea of comedy, I think, because that's what's so interesting about reading about this film, is that some critics found the subject matter to be just bad taste beyond the pale, you know. So like Bosley Crowther, who's reliably wrong on lots of things, but his reviews are quite easy to find online, so he's always a good one to quote. But he said, a callous comedy, a shocking compression of realism and romance. You might almost think Mr. Lubitsch had the attitude of anything for a laugh, but he wasn't alone in this case. I think C.A. Lejeune, who wrote for the Observer newspaper over here in England, to my mind, a farce set against the agonies of bombed Warsaw is in the poorest of tastes, especially as the film makes no attempt to ignore them. I mean, you could argue it would have been in worse taste to ignore them, I think, but anyway. And then Dillis Powell in the Sunday Times, like, praised the actors. I think a lot of people who didn't like the film often said, well, Carol Lombard was very good, et cetera, et cetera. But she said, is the joke funny? Is the background of terror in Poland funny, with its constant reminders of the frightful reality? I find myself wondering how America just now would take a brilliant bit of farce about Pearl Harbor, and how we in this country should react to a perfect scream about the fall of Hong Kong. So that's interesting. Like, is there any subject matter that's not appropriate for a comedy? Is it almost impossible? Some people would say it's almost impossible to approach the Holocaust without being manipulative, for instance. But I feel like you've got to sort of take it case by case. You can't really preclude the possibility that somebody will come up with something that's dazzlingly funny, no matter what the topic, I think. But yeah. What do you guys think?
I don't know. I didn't find Pearl Harbor funny. I thought it was a bad movie. but I don't think that there are topics that can't be made fun of. I think there are topics that can be made fun of that people are not going to find funny, you know. And that maybe I'd find it funny, and that maybe they won't, and maybe they have good reasons for it. Not funny, not funny. Like, if there was something that like, one example, like, a very soft example of this, like, something I didn't find funny, is being in the UK and hearing a lot of kind of, when I lived in London, at the time, I think Keith Lemon was doing one of these shows, and one of the catchphrases, because there was an Irish, like, guest or something, was, potato! And I would hear that all the time, like, directed at me, and I didn't find it funny. I kind of had a good humor about it, because I realized that, like, I'm not meant to find it funny. I am the butt of the joke. And sometimes I'll make jokes and other people will be the butt of the joke, and maybe they won't find it funny, and I'll have to apologize, and I'm fine with that. But maybe it was funny for me. Maybe it was funny for other people. But there is a question of sensitivity. But I don't think it's possible for a subject matter to be kind of intrinsically unfunny. Because I think if it was, then there would be certain people who wouldn't be able to process it. You know.
Well, comedy is a genre that you can't really quantify. Like, again, we joke about the six laugh test, but, like, the six laughs for me are different than the six laughs for Andrew and that sort of stuff. It is impossible to, like, that's the whole point of view.
It's same for sad movies. Like, you can,
emotions, anything that requires an emotional response.
Yeah. You
know? I love that Andrew earlier on was, when we were talking about, like, theories of humor, Andrew was like, yes, and theories of humor are nonsense because it's either funny or it's not, which is true, because it is actually either funny or not to you as an individual, like, audience member. Yeah. I do think that, like, time helps, though, in these cases as well.
I was going to bring this up, yeah.
Like, I think that, like, To Be or Not To Be is much better regarded today than it was on its initial release. And I think even, say, Team America World Police, to pick an example, which I think, like, the Irish Times named the second best movie of the 2000s. On initial release, people were like, is this funny? This seemed rather tasteless and tacky. Why are we doing this? What's the point of it? And I would argue it's somewhat comparable to Do Be or Nothing.
Because there's that idea of comedy equals tragedy plus time, isn't there? Which I think is often attributed to Mark Twain, who may have said humor equals tragedy plus time. But I think it's also associated with the American TV personality Steve Allen had said something. He said, when I explained to a friend recently that the subject matter of most comedy is tragic, he said, do you mean to tell me that the dreadful events of the day are a fit subject for humorous comment? The answer is no, but they will be pretty soon. So I think there is something to that, yeah.
I mean, there's the classic Marx quote about like how history repeats itself first as tragedy, second as farce. And I do think, like, again, not to bring too back to like the structure of the movie, I love that the structure of To Be or Not to Be inverts that. So like you constantly see things as farce and then as tragedy, which is very clever as well. But yeah, I think that's a fair observation.
I think that's kind of being challenged, kind of in, as in when it comes to kind of publicly consumable, you know, popular comedy, I think that is true. But I think like comedy per se is always trying to push the, sometimes disastrously, and sometimes successfully. But sometimes it's disastrous and you're never going to hear from that comedian again because their career is
burnt,
over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for other comedians, it's their stock and trade. Like the whole kind of, Gilbert Godfrey thing, not that he's a particularly successful comedian and he would probably agree, but
he's a name, you know him and you know his voice, you know his face.
And
he got to perform at Disneyland.
That's it. And in fairness to Gilbert, he's done a lot of good work in recent years around kind of autism awareness, but his kind of shtick was in part like, not, it wasn't just his voice. It was about kind of making jokes when it's too soon, you know, talking about 9/11. And a lot of the joke is he doesn't even have to say anything. Like he can start with like a setup and you know, there's going to be some kind of a punchline about 9/11 and it's going to be terrible. And everyone is kind of holding their head in their hands and there's a kind of a nervous, laughter, like how people find that they can't stop laughing at like funerals or like inappropriate times, which feels very kind of real, I guess.
When I was watching this film, I was thinking about, have you guys ever heard what the filmmaker Michael Haneke said about Schindler's List? He said that there's the sequence in Schindler's List where the women are led into the gas chamber or into the showers, and you don't know whether it's going to be gas or water that comes out of the shower head. And he thought the film was kind of reprehensible because of that. And it's interesting that something like Schindler's List is kind of how you're supposed to do a story about oppressed Jews during wartime, isn't it? It's very worthy and serious. I think it's a very good film, but I think I can see what he means about that particular sequence and it being manipulative.
Yeah.
And yet a comic treatment such as you get in To Be or Not to Be more obviously raises people's hackles, doesn't it? Although I think what makes it work so well is that the ideas are pointing in the right direction, you know? So,
yeah,
I don't know. It's an interesting, I don't know. It is particularly difficult with this kind of subject matter. I think Lubitsch manages it superbly, but yeah.
I mean, again, it's been pointed out. I listened to the commentary on the disc here and the point was made that like, it wasn't that To Be or Not to Be was like tackling Nazism and that was beyond the pale. Like The Great Dictator came out the year beforehand, for example. The Three Stooges like had You Nasty Spy, which was successful enough to spawn a sequel called I'll Never Hail Again. It wasn't that this stuff was beyond the pale, but I think the argument was that it was A, that stuff happened before Pearl Harbor and therefore it was distant and it wasn't in the public consciousness and it didn't affect American audiences as directly. And the second point that was made was that it threw audiences and critics off, and we kind of discussed this already, because of that bending of genre and also just like the bending of like the standard narrative of this, where, you know, you're meant to see the Nazis as inhuman monsters and instead you get lines about how, you know, literally seeming to reference the Shylock speech from The Merchant of Venice,
yeah,
as if to like take one of the great kind of, you know, anti-Semitism points in like literature and kind of like say, oh yeah, but this also logically applies to Nazis. If you prick Nazis, do they not bleed? If you tickle Nazis, do they not laugh? And that maybe also contributed to it feeling uncomfortable.
But that's, I feel like, well, maybe I'm being too kind of generous to the movie, but I feel like it's in bad faith when Seletsky says it. That is kind of sophistry when it comes out of his mouth. That he's not saying it because he's a victim. He's saying it because he's a villain.
No, he's saying it because he's horny.
And he's horny. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, like,
I'm not saying he's a villain because he's horny.
We don't make those judgments on the 250. No, but yeah. I would argue that's another point of the kind of humanism of it. It's that more explicit form of kind of what we call the Lubitz touch, the ability to get stuff past the censor. But you have like the paralleling of Sobinski and Seletsky, like when they're courting Maria, and you know, Sobinski's like, I can drop 3 tons of dynamite in 30 seconds. And in contrast, you have Seletsky saying, you know, I'll have you saying Hail Hitler by the end of the night. And like, yeah, you know, again, maybe it's not tickle them, do they not laugh? But it's like, put Carol Lombard in front of them in a lovely dress, and do they not become immediately sexually aroused? Yeah. Like, are they not also human? Do they not have the same basic human response to this stimulus? That sort of thing.
That was one of my favorite moments in the film, actually, is early on when Lombard appears in that gorgeous dress and says, you know, it's for a concentration camp scene, and she says she thought it would make a nice contrast.
and again, like that, but that's like a setup and a payoff, because later on, when she goes in front of the Nazis, when she goes to Seletsky, she's not in rags or being tortured.
No.
She's in the ball gown and dress looking fabulous. Like, again, that performativity thing, it's so beautifully constructed. Sorry.
It's interesting as going back to kind of like that, how this I think isn't one of these cases of a Hollywood film kind of, you know, patting itself on the back for being, you know, for doing like for having the best jobs in the world in the best
and getting paid
and
very very yeah, well yeah, yes yeah.
And because there's vanity in, like, she and the other kind of actors are the heroes of the movie, but there is vanity in everything they do.
Yes.
You know, that
well, I mean, like, Joseph gives himself away because he can't help but feel angry at the fact that his wife might be cheating on him. Like, he
cuckolding him.
Yeah, he cannot get past that. He's like incapable of like masking that as an actor. Which I love.
Yeah, I think that's significant, because I think that's where Jack Benny, and this would have been more evident at the time if we're saying he's kind of a forgotten figure to today's audiences, but from what I can gather, his comic persona was made up of a kind of a combination of meanness and vanity. So apparently on his radio show, he violated a lot of the social norms about what it means to be an American man, you know, because he would be wealthy, but also a cheapskate. You know, he thinks he's God's gift to women, but unable to attract women, sophisticated, but can't handle simple situations. So I think what helped him is there's quite an assiduous publicity campaign to demonstrate that he wasn't like his comic persona in real life. You know,
when you Google him, there are lots of pictures of him with small children smiling. You could tell that, yeah,
this is
the
it.
The studio is very much like, we need to communicate that he's a nice guy.
Yeah, apparently the publicity very much foregrounded his family and the idea that he was benevolent. Yeah, so the interesting thing is, I think it's more his vanity that's in evidence in To Be or Not to Be than his meanness. And it's apparently in his radio show and on TV later, his vanity would be over things like his age. But here it's displaced onto this idea that he's a great actor, you know, which is very funny.
Well, there is the kind of age vanity as well, because he's playing Hamlet. Like, that's the ultimate kind of vain actor thing, is like, I haven't played the Dane. It's like, you're 52. The character is a teenager.
Well, to be fair, don't they say you have to be at least 30? So they recommend that most actors are 30 before they play the role of Hamlet.
Yeah.
I mean, it is worth, like, again...
What age was Laurence Olivier? He was in 1948. Probably, yeah. I
don't know.
It wasn't too egregious anyway. I enjoyed it. Yeah.
I mean, but also I feel like when you're comparing other actors to Laurence Olivier, you know, very few actors come out particularly well.
I'm going to go ahead and say it. I think Laurence Olivier is better than Jack Benny.
Whoa, okay.
That's my opinion.
Big claim. But well, what I've read is that a lot of Jack Benny's films apparently were poor, which I think must be why we don't really know him that much today. I mean, I don't know how much you guys knew about him before, but apparently Lubitsch always had him.
I've heard the name.
Yeah, apparently Lubitsch always had him in mind for the part, and he said to Benny that you're not a comedian, you're not even a clown, you're an actor playing the part of a comedian, and this you were doing very well. So he saw something that other people didn't. And there's also a good story about Jack Benny's father, who attended a screening of To Be or Not to Be with his nurse, watched the first scene where Benny's playing a Nazi officer, apparently. So he stormed out of the cinema, Benny's dad, after seeing that, you know, shocked by the sight of it. And then later was told to go back, and he went back and completely changed his opinion. So it kind of mirrors the response to To Be or Not to Be, in that he didn't like it the first time he saw it, and then retroactively he reappraised it. So that's kind of nice.
And it's worth noting, actually, you mentioned that, like, we don't have that many Jack Benny movies on the list, and that I think this is literally the only one. But, like, I'm going through Benny's IMDb page here, because, of course, this is an IMDb podcast, and we like lists and names and stuff.
I do a lot of anti-Japanese movies.
What I do find interesting is that Benny, ignoring like his long running appearances on TV and sketch shows and like the work that he did there, he primarily plays himself, particularly in movies like around this time in his history. So like he's popping up in cameos in John Wayne movies, playing himself, which is kind of amazing. It's like Without Reservations in 1946, Jack Benny playing Jack Benny. The Great Lover, Jack Benny playing Jack Benny. Somebody Loves Me, Jack Benny playing Jack Benny. Boo James, Jack Benny playing Jack Benny uncredited. Bachelor Father, Jack Benny playing Jack Benny. The yeah. You know, and in The Mouse That Jack Built, he voices Jack, surprisingly. In Gypsy in 1962, he's playing Jack Benny. He pops up in It's a Mad, Mad World playing Man in Car in Desert. He doesn't, like, he was not, you know, as much as kind of Lubitsch joked about him being an actor playing.
It's a Mad, Mad World.
It's a Mad, Mad, Mad
isn't
World.
That, isn't that the thing about...
The premise of it, yeah. It is the biggest comedy
like
ever.
It's overcast.
Whoa, nice. I appreciate it. Yeah. But the idea was that, like, he's frequently compared to, I joked earlier about Seinfeld, but he is frequently compared to Seinfeld, to the point where, like, when Seinfeld, the TV show, premiered, a lot of the coverage of it was, yep, this is very much like a modern day Jack Benny, where he had this personality, as you point out, of being kind of like miserly, being cynical, but surrounding himself with louder characters who generally tended to take the spotlight around him, whereas he just was the cynical wall for them to bounce off. But he was never, he never broke into film, and there's a sense in which he never really wanted to break into film, much like Seinfeld seems happy to be like the richest man in the world who just drives around in his car with lots of people that he has conversations with. B-movie was about it for Seinfeld. B-movie. Yeah, that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I saw a bit of the B-movie the other day, by the way. Sorry for cutting across you, Darren. It was on. I was sort of babysitting, and I was looking at it, and I was like, I have seen this movie. I have no idea. I've forgotten absolutely all of this. It was just incredible. Because generally I have an okay memory for movies. Haven't seen many, but the ones I do see, I remember watching B-movies. Like, what is this? I've definitely seen this before, yeah. Anyway.
I am intrigued to check out some of Jack Benny's comedy, because apparently he rarely told jokes on stage. I think what made him funny was he would rely on things like comic silences, pregnant pauses, and that's how he got his laughs. And being the butt of other people's jokes while still being kind of the figurehead, you know, which you can kind of see where he's still the star of the troupe here. Yeah, you know?
Even while he's surrounded by colorful characters. I mean, like, again, like, to give a sense of like his movie career, like one of his rare Jack Benny playing somebody else but Jack Benny movie appearances was the movie The Horn Blows at Midnight. And it was such a spectacular misfire that apparently several of his shows, not one show, several of his shows turned it into a recurring gag that he had starred in this movie, The Horn Blows at Midnight, which I kind of adore. So yeah, like,
I wonder if I'd like The Horn Blows at Midnight, because that's the thing I find is that I like movies that are punchlines. Like, I like Death to Smoochie. And people will always kind of like say, like, if there's an actor, say, talking to Jon Stewart, they'll say like, oh, well, you know yourself, you've been in, in movies during that dismoochie, and he'll like just shake his head.
But to be fair, like Dan Callahan, who like wrote about like Jack Benny's role here, like when he singles out like, you know, the horn blows at midnight being a running gag for years, in parenthesis, he makes a point to say it really isn't that bad, but it's just bad enough that Benny can milk it for a punchline for decades.
Yeah. I think he has some great moments in this film, though, doesn't he? I think when I think of the things that made me laugh here, so I think his second reading of the "to be or not to be" soliloquy, when the guy walks out on him again, is hilarious. I think there's the scene when he finds him in his bed, doesn't he, and gets him to walk out, and then you get the line, "First you walk out of my soliloquy, and now you walk into my slippers." Well, that was very funny.
What ill wind blew you into my slippers?
Also, when he's as Colonel Earhart, where, you know, we did a concentrating and the Poles did a camping, again, one of probably the outrageous moments that people responded to.
To be fair, they didn't apparently know at the time exactly what was happening in the concentration camps. One of those lines that got really dark, kind of with hindsight.
All right.
I do like as well the line where, like, Maria's like, you know, if I'm in a play, you read the lines. If I'm sick, you get a cough. If we have a child, I'm worried you'll be the mother. And his response is, "I'd be satisfied to be the father," which is just a great line. And part of me is like, I know that Andrew's like, well, censorship office, if you call that out, you're the perverts. Part of me is also wondering, how do you get out? Like, that's a stunning line. That's a stunningly provocative line.
Yeah, we should talk about Lombard, because she has some great stuff too. And I think she desperately wanted to work with Lubitsch, is what I've read. She said that the film was the happiest of her career. Obviously, what's tragic about it is she died in a plane crash with her mother. They were selling war bonds on a tour. I think it was just a few weeks after
Vegas, wasn't it?
Yeah, in Nevada. And just a few weeks after filming was completed. Apparently, that meant they had to slightly re-edit the film. I've seen that said somewhere. I don't know what that entailed, though.
They cut a line. So she had a line about catching a plane, because obviously at the end they fly off.
I see.
So they had to cut the line where Carol Lombard says, "I have to catch a plane." Because that was felt like that was beyond the pale. And actually, I would recommend here, if listeners have not listened to the episode of You Must Remember This, talking about Carol Lombard, and in particular, like her marriage to Clark Gable and Clark Gable's response to her loss. Because apparently Lombard was very much all in on supporting the troops, all in on supporting America in the Second World War. A large part of why she took this role was because she felt like she could be doing something to help America and to help encourage people to, because when she signed up, America wasn't yet in the war. And like at the same time, her husband was like, no, that's not what we should be doing as movie stars. I don't have a strong opinion about this. But apparently when she died, Gabe, heartbroken.
Was Gable a war profiteer? Like he was during the Civil War.
back in 1939. No, but he after her death, he threw himself in. He threw himself kind of into the war. He signed up, he enrolled, he insisted on being sent to the front lines. There's all those stories about like Hitler wanting to capture Clark Gable, which again is a kind of a separate podcast of itself. But apparently like a large part
mustache.
Of that was... That's, and it doesn't blow away
better
when you watch an explosion at a train station. Fair point.
I just think that she's an interesting figure. I think very beloved in the 1930s. I think it's been claimed that
Queen of the Screwballs, wasn't it?
It's been claimed that screwball comedies were actually named after her, because I think there was a Variety reviewer. I think it was for the film My Man Godfrey, which might be her best loved role. But the reviewer said, "Lombard has played screwball dames before, but none so screwy as this one," which some people have said that's where the name comes from. But just had incredible comic timing and comic speed, I think. She had a lovable quality, I think very beautiful too, which is, you know, so sad about, you know, cut down at 33. I think all of those things are very useful for Maria. You know, she's a very untamable woman. Her husband can't control her. You mentioned the line about how he would settle for being the father there, which I really liked. But also when she knows Sabinski wants to see her, and she knows somebody wants to see her, and she suspects it's Sabinski. And she says, "I don't like to be rude to him. I think I owe it to my public." That made me laugh as well. The ending's interesting then, isn't it? Because the ending seems to imply that she has a new man who is neither her husband or Sabinski. You know, which I thought was
which
very
I loved,
nice
which I absolutely love that, like the bit where Betty's watching and waiting for Sabinski to get up, and then somebody else gets up, and both Sabinski and her husband are kind of looking on as well. And again, like the fact in which
they're both being cuckolded,
which is and the fact in which like the movie is so like unashamed and so kind of like so like. It's very much a on her side argument as well, which is the great thing about like Jack Benny's character is that he's so, like, he's great, but he's also so terrible that you kind of understand, you're kind of rooting for her in this situation. I kind of, like, again, it, for a movie made by the studio system in 1942, the way in which, like, that infidelity is not even, like, it's not even something to be scolded or disappointed about, or it's just a fact of life, and it's also, like, her best life to a certain extent from the film's perspective, which is kind of amazing.
And also, if we're talking about the Lubitsch touch as being something which is about things that you omit, there's the sequence where about, it's all about going to the bookshop, isn't it, and putting the message in the copy of Anna Karenina. So what happens off screen is that the lieutenant can't go himself. He goes to Maria Chura, tells her about the mission, and she goes to the bookshop herself. Now, in another film, you can imagine that being 10 or 15 minutes of drama. We don't get any of that, do we? We go from the first scene at the bookshop to the second. It all happens off screen.
Oh, the pace is incredible. There's not a dull moment. Yeah, because some, like, writing that, it's almost kind of, you know, logical to go from, like, beat to beat to beat. But it's like, does the audience need this? Or am I just kind of writing it out so it's clear in my head? And if then I can take it out and just kind of, you know, which is what the movie does very well. There's no sort of, there's no exposition really kind of dump. Like I sometimes enjoy exposition in movies, you know, when it's done in a kind of a crafty way, because some kind of storytellers enjoy exposition.
Some of which I've written a book
about. Inception.
Inception is half the movie explaining to you what it's going to do in the second half.
Well, any heist movie like kind of needs to be like that, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, I remember when we were watching Interstellar, Andrew singled out the scene in which, like, during a conversation, is it Matthew McConaughey pulls out a whiteboard and starts drawing on it?
I think you were talking about that one. I was talking about the scene in the school when we know that you're a former engineer and pilot too, and they start like telling the audience a whole lot of stuff about this character. It's like, hey, listen, we know all of that. We know this, that.
We also know this other thing.
Anyway.
Can I just mention one more excellent Carole Lombard moment before we move on, which is when she first meets Sabinski. She says, I pictured you quite differently as a dignified old gentleman, which I thought was very funny because we've seen her talking to the other woman about him before he turns up. So great stuff. But yeah, an incredible comic presence, really. So I think that would be, like I said earlier, I think part of the argument for having this on the top 250 would be to have her on the list, I think.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Is she on the list for anything else? No. My Man Godfrey?
No, not that I'm aware of, actually, which is... again, the 40s are not particularly well represented. We've talked about this in the podcast before, where like the 90s through the present day tend to eat up a substantial portion of the list, whereas all the other decades kind of have to scrounge for bits and pieces.
It's funny that this re-entered then, isn't it? Is it because did you say it was hovering on the boundary with the amount of votes it had?
Basically the amount of votes, and it has actually, it's since kind of fallen, which is why I was interested in covering it while we could, because it's very much kind of, you know the way that the list works. I think we did The Wizard of Oz, and it had literally dropped...
Done a few films.
Dropped out in the time it had taken us to organize the recording of the episode in question. So no, To Be or Not to Be, kind of it. So just a very quick history in terms of where it falls on.
It's all good
because
stuff.
Because this is a podcast about lists, and we like to talk about this stuff. So yep. So it's currently at number 199. Is where it is currently. It has, which is fairly reasonably high in terms of like a 1942 film.
Can I ask how it works with the list? Because I'm not sure, but like at 199, would it have to gradually drop down the list, or is there a way it could just disappear from the list? No.
It would have to drop gradually down the list. What happens is they will occasionally realign it and stuff will drop sharply. So you'll see days where something will drop 20 places. And a bunch of stuff will drop 20 places because presumably they tweak the algorithm to include or exclude or weight certain votes in a particular way.
They had complaints from sharks.
That Jaws was unfair.
The
Anti-Shark Defamation League was like, we feel like this isn't representative. You guys had Free Willy on here for a while. Can you find a similar movie for sharks? But yeah, so to give a quick arc of the movie, so it first entered the list in 2002. It entered quite low, so it was around about sort of 240-ish. Then they changed the requirements back in, I think, 2005. And the reason why they did that, and we talked about this in the podcast before, seems to be because a large number of votes for Indian and Turkish films came in. So they decided to raise the threshold and the number of votes in order to ensure that there would be less Turkish or Indian films on the list.
Good thing, too.
which is a somewhat questionable practice.
I want my list back.
Yeah. Not my IMDb 250 hashtag, says Andrew.
This list that sucks.
You can very much tell. You can very much tell, like, you look at the weeks before the change was implemented and you see a whole bunch of Indian movies entering and Turkish movies entering, then the criteria are changed and all of a sudden it's a much more American and British centric list all of a sudden. And you're like, gee, I wonder if maybe that was a factor or an unintentional consequence. We don't mean to imply anything, though we are very much implied. Well, the Lubitsch touch, we're saying it without saying.
Yes, the Mooney touch. Yeah.
But it entered about 190. It's actually pretty stable then. So it's actually meant to stay about 199 at the moment, which is quite impressive. So
it should be there for a while.
Which is pretty decent as well. So no,
yeah.
So the date it re-entered was May last year. When it kind of snuck in early in lockdown or quarantine. I don't know if that means that more people were seeking out Ernest Lubitsch in quarantine, if he was one get benefited from that quarantine bump that I think
hopefully
mentioned who quite enjoyed that. The famous Swedish director, because I can't.
Contagion.
Contagion did it top the IMDb charts as well. Yeah. but yes. All right then. So is there anything else we're talking about? Anything we haven't discussed already? Anything jumping out at people about to be
Bergman.
Or not to be?
That is the
director I was thinking of there. Thank you. Because my brain is mush today.
Just one more anecdote I wanted to mention. We've already mentioned the remark that Earhart makes about Chira's acting, what he did to Shakespeare, we're now doing to Poland. And it seems like there was a particular outrage about this line. I think I read that there was a dinner after the first screening of the film attended by people like Lubitsch, but also Billy Wilder, Alexander Korda, who produced the film, Charles Brackett, who was a writer. And Lubitsch's wife asked him to take that line out, and Lubitsch exploded with fury, apparently, almost as if he'd been attacked personally. And he wasn't a man known for losing his temper. So I think it just speaks to that sense that this is a film that gave expression to his own political kind of concerns and anxieties. And like I said, people who know about this kind of thing have said it's his most personal film. So I guess it kind of backs that up.
Yeah. And I mean, we should also mention as well, like the previous film that he did was The Shop Around the Corner. And again, people who know far more than me about film have pointed out that the way in which Warsaw is introduced at the start of the movie, like while it goes out of its way to single out the Polish and Jewish names on the signage and to read them out loud, it looks very much like at a small town America. It's presented very much like small town America is in 1930s or 1940s films. The fact in which they make a point to, while all the signage is in Polish, all the actors are speaking in English or American accents, and they're speaking English and American. There are no subtitles in there whatsoever. I like that the movie seems to make this more human. It seems to very consciously make what is happening in Europe more relatable to American audiences by framing it in a way that evokes the way in which American small towns are typically portrayed.
I like to pick some of the jokes that I really enjoyed. I might have misheard this, but when Warsaw is being bombed and the theater is evacuating, I think you hear somebody shout, "Avalanche!" is it an avalanche? And it's like, why did you think that? Is that the avalanche kind of alarm sound that has gone up? Yeah.
But how many avalanches has Warsaw experienced?
There's one gag in it as well, which could, it feels like it's a newspaper cartoon where Hitler just dressed as Hitler, Jack Benny takes the two pilots and says, jump. And they just jump out of an airplane with no parachute. Yeah.
Which is probably the broadest joke in the film.
Yeah.
And very obliging fellows, but it's so kind of it's so profound as well. Like, you know, in the sense of like the people's kind of response to authority. Like, that was one of the most kind of upsetting things about get ever so slightly political, like in the kind of 20th century centralization of power and kind of authority. It's realizing that if somebody's, and you know, like all the Ingram experiments and that sort of thing, where you put somebody in a lab coat and they ask you to do something and you just do it.
Probably do it, yeah.
Regardless of the screams or the smells of smoke,
yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And that's true, unfortunately, on a very wide scale, because people don't think about what they're doing or why. You just kind of do it because, anyway, sorry. I don't want to go on a rant. But I thought it was very funny for that reason. Because it's absurd, but it's very darkly comic as well.
Is it worth noting how the movie refuses to give actual Hitler that much space in its narrative? One of the things I actually like is that, like, you have actors impersonating Hitler at several points throughout, but you, first of all, when Hitler's about to give his big speech, they turn off the radio before you can hear his voice, which is great, because you obviously, like, throughout you have like sequences where you see the fake and then you see the real thing, but you don't get to see or hear the real Hitler, which I find is kind of fascinating. Even the shots of him when he enters the theater are from the back of his head, and the way in which the theater is framed like Nuremberg as well, where you have people like standing up and saluting him from the theater seats, which is a very disturbing scene, but is very effective as well. And just
I think they felt his charisma would be too much, and that people would come
Jack
away.
Jack Benny
from
wasn't going to share third billing.
With a very different kind of feeling about that the director didn't intend. It's like, that Hitler guy seems cool, doesn't he? Sorry,
because there's also the moment where is it Bronski, the actor playing Hitler, and the director says he doesn't feel like he looks like Hitler. And he also says that the picture looks wrong, you know, so that idea of the boundary between what's real
and
what's
the line
not,
beforehand where it's like, he doesn't look like Hitler, he's just a man with a funny mustache. And the response is, that's Hitler, which is great as well. And so you have this idea of like Hitler existing, like you acknowledge what Hitler is without acknowledging Hitler himself somehow, which is quite a daring balance thing to do.
Yeah, and he's a failed artist.
Which makes him particularly susceptible to like real artists. Yeah.
And a vegetarian who sometimes kind of doesn't
swallow his country's whole. Yeah, is what they say. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you can trust anybody who doesn't eat meat, Andrew. That would be my comment.
That is our politics.
That is. And just a quick quote here from the American cinema, because it reminded me a lot of another quote that I wonder if it was a direct reference to it. Andrew Serres, writing in the American cinema, noted of Lubitz, "We shall never see his like again, because the world he had celebrated had died, even before he did, except in his own memory." And that reminded me a lot of a direct quote from Wes Anderson's, like, The Grand Budapest Hotel, where you have a similar conversation about, like, the consequences of a fictionalized Second World War, where you have, you know, Mustafa saying of Gustav, "To be frank, I think his world had vanished before he had ever entered it. But I will say, he certainly sustained the illusion with a marvelous grace." So I do wonder if, like, Wes Anderson kind of, because again, like, the Grand Budapest Hotel is a very Jewish influenced or inflected kind of story. I found that kind of an interesting parallel when I read that line.
But there's a kind of a you see that as well with like the First World War, where there's this kind of death of decency, where there were sort of expectations about kind of like, you know, we're at war, but we're, you know, we're honorable or something, and then finding that, oh, we're not. Yeah, like it's all kind of been being punctured. We have these kind of ideals that are no longer manifest in our reality or something like that.
I think that's what's interesting with To Be or Not To Be, because I think I said that Lubitsch's brand of comedy kind of fell out of favor, but I think a lot of his earlier films were set in a very fantasized version of Europe, European cities like Paris or Vienna. And then it's with films later, like Ninotchka, The Shop Around the Corner, To Be or Not To Be.
They enter the real world.
That
is it?
You still... It gets more authentic, yeah.
Because Ninotchka was controversial in its portrayal of kind of the Russian Communist Party. I think, like, Russia banned it, if I remember correctly. Like, that way...
I think people sometimes group those films together. The three I just mentioned is not a loose trilogy as such, but, you know, kind of a shift.
Right. Is there anything we want to talk about? Anything we haven't discussed already? Anything jumping out at anybody with regards to be or not to be?
Not for me. I think we've covered it pretty well.
Okay. All right. With that in mind, then, what we normally do at the end of the podcast is we ask our guests to recommend something for listeners, something you're enjoying at the moment, be something related to the movie, something unrelated to the movie. And to give Carl a chance to think about it, I'm going to ask Andrew to go first.
Something I used to watch a lot as a child was Laurence Olivier's Hamlet. I have not watched it for a while, but I always enjoyed it, and it made me want to write or do something like that, you know, because it was very sort of grown up, but it was something that I could play at, I guess.
I can't remember the context, but I remember it coming up where, like, myself and another guest were talking about something that we enjoyed as kids, and your response was, "Yeah, well, I enjoyed Laurence Olivier's 1948 Hamlet." Thank you.
No, do you know what it was? It was availability, because it comes around to the music I listen to as well, because there weren't that many, you know, VHSs in the house, but my mother was studying literature and was doing this big kind of was focusing a lot on Hamlet, and had gotten Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, had gotten kind of like she also got Nevermind by Nirvana, so I ended up listening more to Nevermind than she had, because for some reason she wanted to kind of put it to that sort of soundtrack in her mind, which is interesting. But the Hamlet, that is.
Well, I guess that kind of makes sense in terms of, like, teenage angst, actually. That probably does make sense, yeah. Actually, in terms of teenage disconnect, teenage angst.
She's a clever woman. Yeah. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead as well. I don't think it's out at the moment, but something that is sorry, I keep on forgetting the name. It's Alexander Platz, I think, is the new Tom Stoppard, which I think it's possible now to book tickets with actual dates. But we'll
because
see.
This is the world in which we live.
yeah. Look out for that. I may have given the wrong title. I believe it's Leopoldstadt.
And Carl, what would you recommend for listeners? What are you enjoying at the moment?
I'm going to recommend a film I only heard of recently, but it kind of fits with To Be or Not To Be because it shares an emphasis on a kind of performance. It's a film from 1978 and it's called Hooper. Like I said, I hadn't heard of this until recently, but it's directed by Hal Needham, who made Smokey and the Bandit and The Cannonball Run. And this is another film he made with Burt Reynolds. So Burt Reynolds stars alongside Sally Field. So Reynolds plays a daring stuntman for an action star who's making what appears to be a James Bond-esque action film. And one of the funny jokes is that Adam West plays the big film star and Burt Reynolds is his stuntman. What's interesting about the film is it has this very charming hangout vibe. You know the way some of Tarantino's films are described as hangout movies, like Jackie Brown.
Maybe Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Stuntman, yeah.
Yeah. It has that kind of feeling to it. There's lots of impressive practical stunt work. What took me by surprise is that as it wears on, you get this sort of pathos generated, because the idea is that Reynolds' character is getting older. His body's giving him more trouble than it used to. He's got this younger rival stuntman who's seems to be threatening to rise up and challenge his status. So I didn't expect it to be as touching as it actually was. I thought it was a surprisingly good film. Burt Reynolds is someone I haven't seen as much of as I would like. He's, you know, one of those people who really likes Boogie Nights. I've seen Deliverance. I've seen one or two of his other films, but not much beyond that. And I don't think this is one of the films you always hear him associated with. So I just thought I'd flag it up. He gives a very charming performance. It's very obvious watching it while he was such a big star back in the day, I think. So, yeah, Hooper. I'm not sure if it's widely available, but, yeah, good stuff.
Did you say that was the sequel to Smokey and the Bandit?
No, same director.
No, the same director, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and also starring Sally Field as well, because Sally Field is in...
Yeah, Sally Field's in that,
Reynolds,
yeah.
And Brad Reynolds, right?
Yep, yep.
It's the dream team, baby. It's the dream team.
Dream team, yeah.
Because I think Hooper. What we talked about once upon a time in Hollywood, one of the influences on Brad Pitt's character of Cliff was I think Burt Reynolds and his stunt double, which is kind of interesting as well.
Is that right? Believe, of course. And he was going to be in the film, wasn't he, before he died?
As well, Reynolds, yeah. He was, which is kind of striking. So that's kind of an interesting. I suspect another kind of Tarantino overlap here, because we mentioned To Be or Not to Be is obviously a touchstone for Inglourious Basterds as well. In terms of recommendations for myself, just because I watched it recently, another movie that deals with the absurdity of war, makes people feel deeply uncomfortable, and comes from a director who has been explicitly influenced by To Be or Not to Be, and another obligatory RoboCop reference, I rewatched Paul Verhoeven's Starship Troopers during the week, and it is a masterpiece. It remains a masterpiece. It's probably his second best film, I would argue, behind RoboCop. Which
like,
is stunning.
Like RoboCop, there is a trilogy. there's at least three Starship Troopers.
There are
movies.
Marauders, and Casper Van Dien comes back for the third one.
Yeah, a friend got me the three, and like whoever made them appreciates in part what made the movies popular. You know, but not entirely.
Okay, so is the in part nude pretty people and the not entirely the satire?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, yeah. there's nudity in all three. So yeah.
So I rewatched that. I thought it was fantastic as well. And also, I should probably mention
that was
this as well.
Well coded, Darren.
Yeah, I your Lubitz touch was just like imperceptible. Exactly. Whenever I say Lubitz touch, I keep hearing like Genesis singing Invisible Touch in my head now. He seems to have a Lubitz touch. But anyway, and finally, because this podcast is coming out roughly mid-June, I would also recommend cinemas. They should be reopening in Ireland. And there should be some good stuff opening in them. So go to your local cinema, attend a movie there. The Father will be opening, which we covered earlier in the year, will be opening in Irish cinemas this weekend as well. And I think it's well worth your time. All right, with that in mind then, where can we find you, Carl? Watch up to?
You can find me on Twitter at CKJSweeney. As we record this, several weeks before it goes out, this is actually the first Movie Palace recording, like crossover in this instance, but the first one I've done in quite a while, because I think the national lockdown over here, January through March in particular, was kind of tough. The kids were at home from school and so on. So I'm just getting back into recording now. But by the time this comes out, hopefully I will have started to release episodes again. I think my episode on The Sound of Music will definitely be out before this one is. Some of the other films I may have already covered or maybe coming down the line include Now Voyager, Dr. No, and I think I've got one or two other things lined up as well. So looking forward to getting back in the podcasting saddle.
Well, to that I say, Doctor, yes.
Yeah. So the podcast can be found at Movie Palace Pod on Twitter, by the way.
Perfect. All right, then. We'll be back next week when the...
You have to do your one-liner in the Sean Connery voice. sorry, Darth.
Yeah,
I beg your pardon.
For that, we share Dr. Yes. And I apologize to all Scottish listeners for that. And we'll be back next week. We'll be continuing our trend. We've looked at some fantastic films. We've journeyed through world cinema and classic cinema. So next week, we're going to be discussing 250's favorite director, Uwe Boll's Blood Rain, with the wonderful Billie Jean Doheny. And then don't worry if that's not your speed, because the following week as well, we will be discussing Fargo on its 25th anniversary with the fantastic Stacey Grout and the wonderful Renaud Gregor. So we hope you'll join us then. Take it easy, guys. Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much.
See ya.
Carl.
Thanks, Bo. Really enjoyed it.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Real talk, the We Made This movie show.
I watched Rabid Grannies on YouTube for free, and it's got hundreds of thousands of watches. And these are things that they've already made their profit from. So these old films, the Troma just stuck them all up and made some extra money off them, and bravo, because they weren't making money from these extortionate eBay sales, but they made money from the free views on YouTube. So I think that's ace. I think bringing those ludicrous films to a new generation, or indeed an old generation who don't want to pay insane amounts, it's nothing but a positive thing.
I didn't know about that.
We dig music.
I need to be very careful this month who I slag off. In the 1968 episode, I slagged off Nick Kamen, and he died.
Did you f***ing kill him?
Yes, I killed Nick Kamen.
Did you kill him with your thirst, just imagining him in that advert? Your weird, thirsty thoughts just finally did for him.
You do realise, Tracy, I've just recorded your confession and I will be sending it to the authorities. try not to kill anyone, Tracy.
I'll try. Say.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast.
But my whole world fell apart. And all they could do, the whole universe, was to silently move on. A quote from author and poet Khadija Rupa. There's one thing about trauma that's especially cruel. It's not the physical and psychological scars you'll have to carry with you your entire life. And it's not the friendships or relationships that may end because of the emotional ramifications as a result of it. It's that life goes on.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Hello everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/ We Made This, that's patreon.com/ We Made This, and get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.